right, welcome back or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais. And the idea behind these conversations is to sit down with people who are on the path of mastery to better understand what they're searching for and to really dive into what is their psychological framework. And the reason that's important is so that we can have some context and some understanding about why and how they make decisions. Oftentimes when we have conversations with people that are just wonderfully switched on, it sounds like they say much of the same as other people that are also switched on. And in these conversations, it's the context and the backstory of their framework about how they understand how the world works and how they fit in it that really is the peeling back of the onion, if you will, to understand how they value the decisions that they make, what they've learned from those decisions, and how they orientate themselves to do things in the future. So the center of what we're trying to get to by the end of the conversation is like, what are the mental skills that they find to be valuable and how are they training them? Okay. And it's the how that's way more important than the what. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing. It just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery. Or use the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. So this conversation, we get to sit down with Nicholas McCarthy. And if you're interested in strategies for building confidence for yourself, or how, if you're a parent, how to help build a framework for confidence for your sons and daughters, you're going to love this. We get into imagery. We talk about risk taking and the process of going for and achieving these bold and counter to popular belief goals that, you know, in this case, at least one that we talk about that has never been done before. I think you're just going to love this conversation. And I think that you'll appreciate the insight and the sensitivity that Nicholas conveys about his craft and as well as how he thinks about growth. So he's captured the knowing of what it takes to really hold true to one's vision, even when others don't see or feel or believe that it's possible. And I know that all of us have had that little voice in our head or that external voice where other people have said, you might not want to be thinking that way. So he knows what it takes to adjust and pivot and flow and fight and at the same time, stay the path that's most authentic and most honest to his journey. And that idea of being honest and authentic, that's no easy task. So that for me, that's what I think we're about to pay attention to with Nicholas. And he's really captured an authentic way to express himself, not only through his craft, but also the words that he chooses. So Nicholas is a concert pianist who at an early age, or early on, he realized based on what other people were telling him that pursuing this path would be a waste of time. He didn't buy it though. And he did not believe that he didn't have what it took. So Nicholas was born without his right arm. And in this conversation, we learn how he stayed the course to graduate from the prestigious Royal College of Music in London. That's no joke. It's a big deal. And in fact, to become the first person to do so in the 130 years of the history without having his arm. So it's a wonderful accomplishment. But more so than that, it's the trajectory that early on, the way that he was using his mind that we're going to talk about and really be able to play with. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. Nicholas, he's performed extensively throughout the UK. That's where he's based out of. And, you know, he's been at the Royal Albert Hall performing there. And he's been all over the world, you know, South Africa, South Korea, Malta, you know, and extensively in the US as well. So I hope you love this conversation. Let's jump right into it with Nicholas. Okay, Nicholas, welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. And I've been tracking your work for some time. And it's fascinating what you've been able to figure out. So, yeah, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Okay, so when did you first begin to have the idea that you wanted to become a pianist?
It was actually really late. I'm from a completely unmusical family. My parents are both just, you know, normal, hardworking people. They're both salespeople for a living. And we just had a very normal childhood. And I didn't really discover classical music and the piano until I was 14, which is really, really late for someone who then goes and makes their career as that, you know, that instrument of choice. And it was when I was at school, I saw a friend of mine, a very accomplished pianist who'd been playing for years, play a Beethoven piano sonata. And I saw her play and I just had one of those light bulb moments really that you see on television and you see on films where I'm like, oh, that's what I want to do. I want to become a concert pianist. Not really kind of taking much attention about the fact that I only had one hand. I kind of ignored that bit. And you know what it's like when you're a teenager, you have this steely determination that you're invincible. So I think that I kind of had a bit of that in me where I just thought, oh, I've got one hand. Oh, I can be a concert pianist. It's fine. So that's how it started.
Okay. And that's a great jumping off point for us to understand, like, what are the important parts of your journey that would help me or us understand who you are? That seems like one of them, but what are the important parts of the journey?
I think for me, you know, my whole journey, because I came from such a humble background with, you know, no musical training, because most people, when they're playing an instrument, they start at the age of 2, 3, or 4. They have, you know, regular lessons in their instrument. They practice hours a day from a very young age. So by the time they're 14, they've usually played their first debut with an orchestra. They've usually played recitals and things. Whereas I was just outside on my bike or playing my PlayStation like a normal kid. So, you know, I think in that sense, that journey is quite unusual for someone to then go into a very highly skilled, you know, musical job. Secondly, the fact that I had one hand, I was born without my right hand. So for me, I've always kind of known I was different, of course, physically, I have one hand, but I was always brought up to feel that I was no different. My parents really did instill in me that anything is possible. If you believe in yourself, you can achieve it. And my parents always instilled in me as well that, you know, most things can be adapted. So, you know, things which would appear like, oh, well, a one-handed person really wouldn't be able to do that. Often with a little bit more thought and you have to think out of the box, you can then adapt it very, very slightly, and it means that I can actually do it. So, yeah, my parents, I really thank for that, for instilling that kind of that mentality in me, kind of turning those challenges into a positive thing.
Is there a particular moment in time where you remember that message coming through for you? And if so, let's celebrate that. But if not, I'm wondering if it was more a consistent message over and over again.
It was definitely a consistent message over and over again. But I think, you know, one example, I remember I was brought up in a very small village, and in our little kind of our little street, it was all kids my age, and all the parents. It was a very close-knit community, so all the parents knew each other, all the kids, you know, we all knew each other and played together and things. And a couple of the parents had said to my mum and dad, and I'd overheard, it's such a shame, you know, because obviously all the kids are starting to learn to ride their bikes now, and Nicholas won't be able to ride a bike. And I overheard it. The next minute, I asked my mum and dad if I could have a bicycle for my birthday or Christmas or whatever it was. So they did. And I had in my head, it was a challenge for me to be the first person out of my group of friends to ride my bike without training wheels, which I did. And I remember when I did that, and all my other friends still had their training wheels on and I didn't have mine on. And all the parents were just like watching me, like crying. Quite happiness, you know, quite like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, he's doing this. So I think things like that, I always had that, you know, people would always doubt, which I think that's natural. I don't, you know, disagree with that, but people are always quite doubtful about people's abilities. And that to me is, I've always taken that as a little challenge. I don't speak about it a lot, you know, in my inside. If someone says, oh, you can't do that, I'll be like, well, I think I can, I'll go and try. And then I'll really, really try to make it a success.
So when you have, okay, so the motivation or drive is stimulated from someone or something outside of you saying that that's not possible. Is that
right? Yeah, that happened for you? Piano when I was later on.
Okay, so you generate energy and momentum from somebody or something outside of you saying that can't be done. And then what do you do with that? Inside, do you have a picture? Do you have a talk track? Do you have a way of getting your mind around what is possible when they said what isn't? Can you talk us through?
I think it's the way, you know, that phrase, you can't do that. I just don't like it. And I think inside that kind of gets to me, and I kind of feel like, well, I may not say it to the person because I know it's never coming out. I mean, obviously in life I've always had a few comments thrown at me, and I probably will have a lot more comments thrown at me. But, you know, these people, like that parents I mentioned about the bike, they weren't being nasty. They were just being quite caring and just saying, oh, it's a shame that he won't be able to ride a bike. For me, that gets in my head, and I'm thinking, well, how do you know? You haven't got anyone one-armed who you know, and you know, and that thing. Now, so much, I think with the Paralympics and all the amazing Paralympian athletes that we have, and we see it on the TV all the time now, that, you know, that anything is possible. Whereas, kind of in my, you know, years ago when I was first starting, when I was young, it wasn't as common to see these amazing superhumans doing amazing things, even though they've only got, you know, one or two or missing limbs or whatever. So yeah, I think for me, I internalize that negativity and I really swap it and I really kind of channel it into a positive thing. More for me, and I'd be lying if I didn't say to prove the other person wrong. you know, it's always a good feeling proving someone else wrong, isn't it?
I think so. I enjoy that, but I don't know if everyone does. That's
what,
yeah, you enjoy it. And I think you really capture this experience really well, which is, and if I'm trying to get my, this is what I think makes you really special. So you've got, I don't know what the right word is. It's not like, I don't feel like you embrace the word handicapped. It feels like you've got a deeper challenge than somebody with two arms. But I want to hear how you talk about, you know, your experience there. But this is what I think makes you really special, is that you feel challenge from outside of you. The word you can't, or the notion that something can't be done by you as well as somebody else. And you're like, oh yeah, okay, watch. And then I want to pull that apart if we can, if you can teach me to say, as soon as you hear you can't do something, I want to know what you do with it. Do you feel something? Do you create a talk track around it? Do you have an image in your mind of what it would look like for you to be successful? Can you pull that apart a little bit and teach from that?
I think it's probably, I mean, it's obviously something which I don't, it's obviously a natural reaction for me. If someone tells me I can't do something, then I do tend to have this natural reaction where my mind just goes into, it must do, subconsciously go into overdrive, where I think, well, I can do this, and how am I going to do this? Well, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to prove you wrong because I'm going to do it this way. Mm-hmm. So I think probably, I can, now you're asking me, I think I visualize myself doing the thing they told me I can't do.
Okay.
Like, for instance, when I was told I would never be a pianist, I could see me walking on stage to thousands of people with nothing but a grand piano on stage and me. And I think that kind of visualization and that image, that very, very clear image in my head, really helps me to keep focused on that image and focus on that dream, if you like, of succeeding that and achieving that goal.
Okay. Did that image come at the very beginning, or was it first an idea that I wanted to be a pianist, and then it turned into a crisp image that helped to continue the motivation? Or was it right from the get-go, you had an idea of riding your bike or being on stage? And if you pull that string just a little bit further, right when you heard those parents say, oh, poor Nicholas, you know, it's such a shame that he won't be able to be part of, you know, his friends riding bikes. It sounds like you had a reaction, like an emotional reaction to it.
I think probably a bit of upset inside, because, you know, nobody likes to be told, oh, you can't do that. So I think instant reaction for me would probably be a bit sad, you know, why? You know, I know I'm different, but why? You know, that sad reaction that someone else is putting their view on me, even though they don't actually know what I'm capable of.
Okay.
They're kind of just putting their preconceived ideas onto what they might be. They might not, you know, if they had one hand, they might not ever have ridden a bike without training wheels on.
I love it. So then keep going. Go back to that moment. So then sad.
So that initial sadness very, very quickly turns into a tenacity, a kind of a upset that goes away. And I'm like, well, you wait and see what I can do. You know, that kind of thing. It's a quick reaction. I'm talking kind of a couple of minutes.
Yeah. So sadness, and it's not intense, but it's like, ah, and then it turns into, okay, watch.
Yeah. Like a flatness, you know, when you're kind of like, someone's knocked the wind out of your sails.
Yeah.
That feeling where you're like, oh. And then 2 minutes later, I'm like, right, okay, well, you wait and see. Give me some time.
Okay. And then from that moment, that intensity that you have about, okay, watch, because that's using the external world. It comes inside of you. You feel it. And then you convert it into energy.
Yeah.
Right? And then once you convert it into energy, and I don't mean energy like woo-woo energy, but like momentum. Maybe. Yeah, momentum. Yeah. And then from that momentum, it sounds like this is where the next bridge is for me. It sounds like either you create an image or you continue with the talk track around, what do I do next? Okay, I got to go to mom and dad. I got to get a bike. And then once I get a bike, what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to watch other kids, you know, and see how they do it. Or I'm just going to get on it and figure it out. Like, what if you kept going? Because this is, I think, one of the things that makes you really special.
I think with that image, like I said, that I think that is that initial image in my head, and then you're probably right, that kind of my own voice in my head saying, okay, so how are you going to do that? How, you've got one hand, how are you going to balance yourself on that bike? How are you going to show people that you can play the piano as good as a two-handed person? And that whole, you know, almost trying to question myself as if I was one of those negative people, you know, almost questioning myself and challenging myself with their ideas.
Whoa, that's really, that's different.
It's funny you're asking this, because it's I don't ever think, you know what it's like, I don't ever think of the process that it happens all the time. You know, it's happened so many times in my life. So it's funny actually talking about it now, that is the process.
Okay.
Which I go through.
Okay.
But it's always been condensed.
And meaning condensed in time, like bang, bang? Like it happens really quick? Like, yeah, okay.
2 minutes of sadness, and then that picture's in my head, and then that talk track sets in of me talking to myself, questioning myself, and that kind of drives me through.
Okay, so let me see if I can play it back, because this is why I was so excited to talk to you, because the challenges that inherently you've had to play the piano at the level that you've played, which is beautiful, and to be able to do it on many grand stages, and then to start late. So all of the, and then to start with one hand, only a left hand, a left arm. So all of these challenges that you have set up against you, or with you, I should say, there's this like moment in time for all of us where we accept challenge or we move away from challenge. We approach success or we avoid failure. And yeah. You have, tell me if I'm too bold with this, you've mastered the approach success model. And most people, Nicholas, I don't even know if you know this, but most people say, oh, that's how I do it too. And many people listening are saying, yeah, that's what I'm about. But then when you give them a chance, they choose, under pressure, I should say, most people choose avoiding failure. And it's a fundamental decision to make. And then you can test it at the moment of pressure. What do you do? Do you go for it or do you play it safe? And what you've done, what you're accelerating for me right now is what is the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps that you take to when, as soon as you feel the as soon as you feel the pressure to go for it or to play it safe. Okay, so let's see if I can play it back for you, and then course correct me where I'm off here. Yeah. Is that you feel something, and it can be any emotion, but the one we're talking about now is like a bit of sadness. From that sadness, there's a quick clip to say, okay, you know what? That's what they think. And then you play back, well, you know what? Is that right? Could I do it? And so you start to question that a bit. And then from
how
that,
would I do it?
And then the questioning goes to, well, how would I do that? And then that turns into an image. I'm guessing, I want to put words in your mouth.
But yeah, no, you're right.
That turns into an image. And then how long do you stay with that image before you get to say, hot damn, you know what? I'm doing this. Like, yeah, I'm doing this. How long do you stay with that image?
I think even now, you know, I travel the world and I play in some of the, you know, finest concert halls of the world. And if I could tell myself, my 14-year-old self, or show them video of my travels to my 14-year-old self now, I don't know. I'd love to be able to do that. But even now, sorry, that's my little dog.
What's your dog's name?
Vinny. She's a Pomeranian. You know that Sharon Osbourne's dog?
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Okay.
The eye roll. Everyone gives me the eye roll when I say that. Sure. I think even when I'm traveling now, say for instance, I'm going to somewhere I've never played before, or a country I've never played before, I have that image in my head still, the same image that I had when I was 14. Of me walking out on stage to a big concert hall with lots of fans cheering, even though I know that I do that every week anyway, and I get that all the time. So I still have that almost a bit of a comfort blanket for me, I think, probably, when I'm going to a new place who people don't know me and I'm playing somewhere new. It's almost like, well, don't worry, because, you know, this is what you want to happen. You know, it's that kind of image in my head where that's what I'd really like to happen, to replicate that in the various countries which I go and perform in. And so I think that image definitely stays stays with me.
Okay, so when you decided to play piano, and it really was a decision, it sounds like.
It was a decision, yeah.
Yeah,
and it so... Like, you know, before that, I used to want to be a chef, which I don't know why I'm attracted to all of these dexterous jobs, the two hands. I mean, that's a fiddly job for one-handed person. but I used to want to be a chef. And that was kind of not a decision. That was a whim, you know, a bit like, oh, I'd like to be an astronaut or I'd like to be a chef. You know, one of those kind of childhood career choices that you change every 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. When it comes to piano, I was so inspired by piano as an instrument, piano, the sound of the piano, the capabilities of the piano, what the pianist looks like playing the piano and everything that goes with it. It definitely was a decision, a conscious decision.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you will check them out.
Okay. All right. So early on, go back to the bike for just a minute. Early on, like bang, 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 right in a condensed version, you had an image and you led to a plan, right? And then you made a decision, well, I'm going to ride my bike before everybody else. And that was like the end game.
That was my goal.
Yeah. And then you just set up and you actually did it. Right? You did the practice. Okay. Yeah. And then for piano, what was the thing that triggered piano for you?
I think it was all, again, there was always the challenge, you know, there was always the fact that, you know, people would say, well, you'd never be a pianist. So in my head, that whole 5-step thing we were just talking about sets in very quickly. Mm-hmm. So that is red rag to the bull. As soon as someone says that to me, it was then like my dying wish that I was going to prove them wrong and I was going to be an international concert pianist. Oh, so I think that is that thing, that the whole thing about piano as the choice of instrument and not something else, or not singing, which would have been a lot easier, mm-hmm. to be a singer, mm-hmm. to train your voices. I think that is just because that is my affinity with the instrument. I just love it. Even now, you know, I get excited when I see a gorgeous, massive, you know, concert grand on stage. There's that, I'm pulled to that instrument more than any other, more than, you know, I play with orchestras all over the world and I see all these amazing, beautiful instruments and £1 million violins and things. They're beautiful, but they don't have that same pull, or I'm not drawn to them like I am to the piano.
That's a really cool thought. I wonder why that is. Like, do you have a sense?
What I want is a beautiful piece of furniture, you know, that's stunning in any room. A lot of, you know, think of a penthouse, then you think of a grand piano in the corner, don't you? Mm-hmm. Most people who own penthouses, they don't always play the piano, but they often want a grand piano in the corner. It looks so beautiful, for one. Two, I think the whole mechanic and the history behind it is so interesting. I think the amount, you know, you press a key and then that sets off a hammer going, which hits a string, and that creates, you know, that whole thing. I like that. I like the fact that it's a very, very complicated instrument, but packaged very beautifully in its elegant piece of furniture. Yet underneath that veneer is a lot of workings and a lot of history and a lot of developments over the years. So I think that whole thing intrigues me. I think it intrigues me. And then the sound, you know, you can create the most softest, beautiful sound that you've ever heard in your life, or you can create a sound with one piano that sounds as big as an orchestra. You know, it really is. The capabilities and the soundscape you can create just using a piano is vast.
Do you have some sort of, Superman power where, like, you've got perfect pitch, or you've got some sort of, you know, some sort of under the surface genetic coding that allows you to be great at this? Or is this a function of vision, dedication, practice, and commitment across?
I don't have perfect pitch, and I don't, you know, as I say, I come from a non-musical family, and I think in regards to my physical ability at the piano, I think I'm, because of my situation, being born with only one hand, I'm more developed to do very, very fast leaps, which two-handed pianists and my old professors used to say, how do you do that? For me, I don't find it that difficult. And I think it's just because I've only ever had my left hand, and I'm used to being very dexterous with my left hand because I do everything with it. So in that sense, I'm able to do maybe slightly more advanced things with my left hand at the piano than a two-handed pianist who doesn't need to do that. They don't need to do the things that I need to do at the piano. So I think in that sense, naturally anyway, even when I first started playing the piano at 14, my left hand was more advanced than a two-handed pianist's left hand would be.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And you hear that with people that struggle with vision or struggle with hearing, that their other senses, their brain figures out how to accentuate other senses. And like, I didn't learn how to ride a bike with one hand. So, like, of course, your dexterity for your one hand is going to be a bit stronger and more sensitive as an instrument than everyone else. Yeah. Okay, so that would be the byproduct of you using your left hand on a regular basis. But it's not something like you said, your family wasn't musical family. You didn't grow up listening to, you know, the classics and meeting some of the great composers of the time. So it wasn't that. It was really that process that I think we just talked through, where you would feel something, you would question if it was real, if you could do it, then you would start to think how, and that how sounds like it's the imagery, and then you would test it and to see if you were crazy or not, right? Mm. And then when you first tested the bike, or piano, I guess it doesn't really matter. This is your process. When you first, let's go back to the bike because it's easy. When you first went back and tested it, how did you work through the struggle of it not going the way you saw it in your head? Because very rarely does that first image.
It doesn't go as seamlessly as as you would think, you know, that image in your head is kind of like, and like I said to you, it's that end goal that is in my head, not the process, it's the end goal. It's me riding a bike with one hand. It's me playing the piano on stage with one hand. It's not the process. So at that time, it's that, you know, I mean, yeah, I think going back to the bike, it was exactly the same as other two-handed people. You know, you fall off hundreds of times before you get it. And then, you know, you don't forget how to do it. And I think it's with that, you know, you just have to, because I had that image in my head all the time of succeeding, I was going to keep getting up and trying and getting back on that bike and trying again and trying again, like anyone would, I would presume, with two hands. But I think with me, I always had that extra need, in a way, to prove the people wrong as well. And that is a big driving force for me.
Okay, I want to pull on this just a little bit more, because when I was riding my bike and I fell, I'm kind of making this up, like, retrospectively.
Yeah, yeah.
But I knew that almost everybody knows how to ride a bike, and I fell. So if other people can do it, I can do it. But they had two hands and I had two hands. Like, they had 2 feet and I had 2 feet. And yeah. So physically, there was not a difference. And so when you had this idea in your head and other people were saying you couldn't do it, and then you changed that idea in your head and you developed a plan and a talk track that you could, and then you fell and you pulled too hard, you know, left or right, and your front wheel twisted and you found yourself on the ground. Okay, so that at that moment, it would be really easy to go a couple directions, right? Which is like, okay, get back on there, let's go figure this out. Or maybe, or, sorry, so let me slow down. Maybe they were right. Maybe this isn't for me. Whether it's piano, whether it's bike, whether it's, I don't know, fill in the blanks. Yeah, and this is also for all of us. At some point in our lives, we hear what other people believe we can't do. And then what we do is we sort it out, similar maybe to how you've sorted it out. We set forward, we take the first couple steps towards climbing our Everest, and then bang, we hit a blizzard, right? And that blizzard might be, is pain, is discomfort, is the process of second guessing. So if we open and expand that moment for you, what did you do then, the first time you fell?
I think for me, because it didn't match my image in my head of successfully doing whatever, that isn't enough for me. If I'm halfway through that thought process, I have to get to that end. I have to get to that image in my head of what I'm doing.
How come?
I don't know why. Why I'm like that, because I'm not like that in other things. If I'm not that worried about something, if I'm not bothered about, you know, I'm not one of these people who has to be the best at everything. Certainly not. And I think it's simply for the fact that I've had the negativity at the beginning. You know, that if someone has told me I can't do something, it's that gets me. It's that creates that absolute need to succeed. Whereas for other things, if someone hasn't, you know, I'm not a hugely competitive person. I am easygoing about various things. You know, it's not about that. I'm not one of these overachievers which has to achieve and be the best at everything. That doesn't bother me at all. So, yeah, I think it is literally that negativity at the beginning, before all those thought processes have been triggered. That negativity is the thing which absolutely creates in me that need to match my image that I have in my head to the reality that has to match for me.
That's crazy. I mean, it's so clear, isn't it, of what we've just been talking about, of how you work through systems, you know, the systems of doubt, if you will. And I guess what I want to understand, because now, like, that, maybe this is your package. Like, this is how you do things. And if you could teach more people how you've done that decision-making process to get you to testing out the model and then committing to the model, that's a really cool process. And that's essentially how, from what I've come to learn, many of the wildly successful entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley or Silicon Forest, or even down in Los Angeles, Silicon Beach, that they have an idea, they test it, and they see if it works, and then they decide again if, based on how the test went, if they should continue with moving forward or not. And it, and you're saying the reason you continue forward is because that first image is so gripping to you about being on stage or riding a bike in front of your friends, that that's the reason you have that tenacity and grit and stick-to-itiveness when other people might not.
Yeah, I think so. For me, that image has to match my reality.
What? How do your... Okay, so high tenacity, high grit, creative... a creative image. It's natural for you to create images. And then, like, all of the moxie to go for something. How do your friends describe you? Because there could be a cost to all of this, right? You could be a pain in the ass.
I could be a pain in the ass. Yeah, I think... My friend, it's funny because my friends are all non-musical, the majority of them. They're all people who I've known for years before I even started to play the piano. So for them, my career, and yes, I've gone on to, you know, be successful, be on television and various things, which of course they're proud of me. But you know what? They don't really care, which is nice. It's a nice thing for me. You know, I could be doing anything. I could be a painter and decorator, and they'd be equally as proud of me. And I think in that sense, they don't often see my processes. They don't often see the things that I have to go through, the hoops that I have to jump through, the times I do have to pick myself up because my image doesn't match the reality of what's going on at that particular time. They don't see that a lot of the time. So, yeah, I think they would be... I don't think they would describe me as a nightmare, I hope. You have to ask them.
How do they describe you? If some of your most intimate relationships were here?
I'm a good listener. They would all ring me, I would say, near the top of their list if they wanted just to sound off, because I am a good listener. If they're angry about something, if they want to rant. You know, my best friend, he rang me the other day, she had an argument with her boyfriend. And she rang up and said, "I just need to rant." And on the phone for 25 minutes, she was like, "Oh, I feel so much better after that." You know, I'm just quite a good listener. So I would say that would be one, that I'm a good listener. Two, I'm reliable. I don't like letting people down on anything. That isn't about like turning up late or something. You know, just letting people down really, really gets to me. I don't like doing it. And of course, I'm human. I have let people down in my time, but it really doesn't sit well with me. So I would say they would say I'm reliable. And yeah, it's difficult. It's weird to think about what other people would think about you, especially when they're your close friends.
Do you have close...
They would say that I'm just fabulous in every way.
That's so good. And do you have close friends with as much as you travel and your commitment to craft? Are you able to have close, intimate relationships?
Yes, very much so. And it's very important to me. I'm an only child, and so my friends are my siblings. So it's funny, I'm not one of these people who I never have a big group of friends who I hang out with who all know each other. I have lots of friends, but they're all one-on-one relationships, and those friends don't know each other and wouldn't necessarily mix. They're very different types of people. You know, I've got friends who are 55 and I've got friends who are, you know, slightly younger than me, and I've got my age friends and I've got even older friends. You know, I've got such a mix, an eclectic mix of people who come from so very, very different backgrounds. And I think that's, and I've just always been very one-on-one with them. So it's a nightmare when it's my birthday on Thursday. So it's funny because I don't have a big birthday meal with all my friends. They all take me out individually. So it's great for me because I go for about 6 or 7 dinners in a week. I mean, it's wonderful.
That's so good, yeah.
Not so great for my waistline, may I say. But I never have a big dinner because the thought of that actually stresses me out because they don't know each other. I'm not 100% convinced that they'll all get on with each other because they're so different.
Mm.
And I've just always been like that. The thought of that stresses me out. Having a big party or something actually stresses me out because I'm so one-on-one with people.
Got it. Okay. So depth of
I think that comes
relationship.
from the fact that I'm an only child. I've always been like that. I like having that very strong, very close relationship with one person at that time. And then I can quite happily go and to another friend and have that same one-on-one personal relationship. But put three or four people in the room and I'm a bit like friends I'm talking about. I'm a bit like, oh, you know what? I don't know. I get uneasy. It's really funny. Whereas when I was at school, I'd see these people and they'd have this big group of friends and they all go on holiday together and stuff. That would just stress me out.
Are you describing more of an introverted process versus extroverted? Like, do you gather energy from listening and going deep as opposed to, bouncing around many different conversations?
Yeah,
And
I think so.
yeah.
But again, though, it depends which friend. It depends. Friend, I have some friends who I can have 25,000 conversations with all at once, and we never finish any of them because we're bouncing from one conversation to another. And I can have other friends who kind of I'm more of a listener because they're, and then I have other friends who I just don't shut up and they're the listener. So it's funny, each of my friends kind of contributes to this. Obviously, for me, what I need from friendship is clearly what I crave from friendship, and each of them do that in their own different way.
And so, if we shift gears just a little bit, how does piano serve you or music serve you? Where your friends have different roles that challenge and provide space for you to be you, how does music do that for you?
Music definitely provides it's therapy, really. It's therapy. It's funny. When I first started getting paid to do my job, to play the piano, it changed for a while because I kind of had to get used to the fact that I was being paid to play a certain concert, and in that concert I had certain pieces which I had to play, which I was contracted to play. And so I was then learning repertoire for a financial gain as opposed to actually the love of music. Maybe it was something which I might not have picked to play. Whereas before that time, I would spend hours and hours just playing pieces which are anything which I thought, oh, I'd love to play that, and I'll get my music out, and then I'd play that, or I'd just be playing anything on the piano with no music. So there was this little shift when I first started kind of, becoming professional. But then luckily that kind of I got used to that, and I got very used to being able to learn things quickly and learn things on a schedule. Which meant that because I knew that everything was going to be okay, and I knew that I'd have this concerto learnt for 2 weeks' time, and I'd have this recital program learnt for the next week, and that's all fine, then I could start to enjoy what I was doing again. But for a good 6 months, there was a time where I really wasn't enjoying the music. I was playing it, and I enjoyed my job, but I didn't enjoy the actual music. I didn't get lost in practice like I used to. But luckily, it didn't last for long. I think it was just a natural transition period. I'm sure, probably, someone who's very interested in tennis and then goes on to become a tennis pro at some stage. There's a difference. It's not a hobby anymore. It becomes a reality, a job, and you have to kind of find that enjoyment in a new way. So luckily, I did. I found that enjoyment, and now, when I do get time, I will go to the piano and I will practice, but it will be my old style of practicing, non-scheduled practice, where I'm not learning a concerto because I have to. I'm learning something because actually I'd like to play that, and I'm not actually ever going to. I haven't been booked to play this yet, but I just want to learn it because that's what I want to do, because it's a hobby.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that transition from amateur to pro. And what happens for most people that I've come to observe and learn is that as soon as they get a manager or they get an agent or they get a coach or they get somebody that's invested in them, both emotionally and financially, that there becomes this new layer of burden. And that burden is to not let them down. Is because
Yeah.
those people have invested and trusted in your potential, your craft, and that gets really confusing for people. So then they fire up this extra layer of intensity to do everything just right, this search for perfectionism to not let others down. And then that becomes this ugly transition from the spirit of amateur to the professional kind of tension of being just perfect. And
all the time, yeah.
And hopefully it sounds like what I heard you say is that you've sorted that out relatively early.
And then and it didn't take long, luckily, but I do remember not being happy in that 6 months.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code Finding Mastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO. apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code Finding Mastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTru.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there.
And so, what is your relationship with practice now?
It's a funny relationship because I'm not particularly structured. I'm quite an organized person, and I'm very, you know, clean and tidy, and I'm quite particular about kind of my environment. Yet with practice, I'm not as structured as I should be, for one, I feel. And I'm not as, and that does come with the travel, and it does come with, you know, various other things. But what I do tends to work. And I'm a big believer of if it's not broken, don't fix it.
Okay.
So even though it's not particularly structured, I would say that it does tend to work for me.
So what are your daily habits? What are the ones that, in kind of the loosely structured process that you have, is there one daily habit that you say, or two or whatever that you say, you know what, these are really important for me. Do you have any of those?
Yeah, I definitely get a bit twitchy if I don't go to the gym. I go to the gym and just do some running, and I think that just clears my head. I never listen to music when I'm at the gym, which is funny. I'm the only person on the treadmill, you know, doing my 5K, and they're kind of everyone's got their headphones in, and there's me without anything in. And I think it's because I'm always around music. I'm always, if I'm not performing it, I'm practicing it. So actually, for me, silence, I love silence. So I think for me, I do get a bit twitchy if I don't get my exercise in, and that's just I exercise for stamina, really. You know, it's a hard job playing for 90 minutes in a concert, you know, and so I have to keep my stamina high. Hence why I run quite a bit, just because I find that seems to help.
What do you do in the silence while you're running?
Just think of anything though. Think of anything, mundane things like, oh, what shall I get from the grocery store today? Or what shall, you know, just, it's just free space just to think. Yeah.
And in that free space, are you critical of your thoughts, or are you just wandering with your thoughts to?
I just let them wander. It can be from anything. It can be if I'm in a frantic, you know, if I'm kind of got a busy schedule coming up, I'll have my list in my head, like I must do that, need to go to the dry cleaners, need to do this, need to do that. But if I'm on a bit of a free week, like it's my birthday week, we just had Easter here, it's quite a free week for me. So when I did my run this morning, it was just free thoughts. I couldn't even tell you what I was thinking about, but it wasn't anything much.
When
It's
something,
not.
yeah, it sounds like it's very freeing. When something comes up that surprises you, what do you do with it?
Surprises me as in good way or bad way.
Either way, like, whoa, look at that thought.
Oh, so in regards to thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. If it's a good way, if it's a good surprise, then I get excited, of course, and then I kind of then that can generate other thoughts. And if it's a surprise where I think, oh, or it's a nasty surprise or something which is, or shock, I won't say surprise, maybe it's a shock. Then it's funny, I tend to go quite, I don't like talking, even though I'm a very good listener, I don't actually like to share too much about an upset or something. I'm quite good at dealing with it on my own. I'll share a little bit, but I don't go into it. I'm not one of these people who'll be crying down the end of the phone for half an hour. You know, I can sort it out on my own. I'll tell you why I'm a bit quiet, but that's about it. So, yeah, I think for me, I would probably just, that's when my thoughts wouldn't be free. That's when my thoughts would be more frantic because I'd be rationalizing this shock and thinking, okay, well, how am I going to do? Well, I'm upset, but why am I going to, you know, that's when they would start to be, my mind would be busier. And I practice hard then. I find it hard to focus.
Practice in piano is hard, or practicing something else?
Practicing again.
Oh, yeah, okay.
If I've had a bereavement or if I've had, you know, something which has happened which isn't what I wanted to happen, then I do find, and I do notice I don't practice hardly at all. And it's not because I don't want to, it's or need to, it's because I can't think past my thoughts.
Jeez, okay. And then
So thing just goes really well in life, and then I can practice.
why don't we just write that into our future?
Yeah,
Every just
can
make
we just
it.
sort that out, and we'll be happy.
Yeah, too much. All right. Do you have any pre-performance routines or anything that you do before you go out and run a program?
Yeah, I don't like getting changed into my concert suite until like 5 minutes before I'm due on stage. Because that's when my nerves start to set in. I don't suffer with bad nerves at all. They're good nerves, but I don't like them too early in the day. You know, some performers and some people I know, they're nervous the day before a concert for the whole day, the whole night. They don't say, I'm not like that. But as soon as my concert gear goes on and I know I'm about to go on stage, that's when my heart rate starts to go. I start getting, you know, flutters in my tummy, and And that's where I pace. I tend to pace up and down my dressing room. I don't like sitting around. And because I'm only doing that for 5 minutes. So that's kind of, that's my, I don't really have a routine, but I would say, I think people would be surprised at how late I get ready to go on stage.
Would you want those, that energy to not be part of your pre-performance routine? Like, would you like to have less, or do you embrace that, no, my body's switching on?
I completely embrace it. And I've had a couple of concerts where I haven't had any nerves whatsoever. And I've been so disappointed in my performance, not from a technical point of view or wrong notes to anything. It was, for me, flat performances.
Yeah.
No spark, no energy, no excitement. And for me, those nerves are so important. If I don't get them, I try and get them. You know, I try and feel like I try and make myself know, which is very, very hard to do. But I try and think of things which can, because I want that performance to be electrifying. I want it. You know, it's my audience. They've paid good money for tickets. I want to give them a good time. So, yeah, for me, that's very important. And nerves are, I think, so important for sports, for performance, for, you know, anything really. It's just how you use them. They can also be debilitating, but, you know, it's how you use them.
Mm, okay. Is there a phrase that guides your life?
Yeah, but the one is always in my head, and it does sound very cheesy, but I'm going to share it with you anyway. But it's just anything is possible, because I truly, truly believe that. Because I think, and I wish I could tell my 14-year-old self this sometimes. You know, when I'm from this small village and no one really has done a great deal, and, you know, to then, for me to have this career, for me to be the one to go out and create the life that I've created for myself and to travel the world and do the things which I do on a regular basis for work, that to me, and having one hand to top it all off, I think that anything is possible thing, I really do truly believe. And yes, it comes with hard work, it comes with determination. And I know, you know, it hasn't all been plain sailing. It's been very, very difficult. But I still believe anything is possible.
It makes sense when you say it. And you're right, it can sound so trite or overused. And I have questions around, is anything possible? But when you say it, you're such an authority in it, because you've mastered that space that we've just talked about, in between when others or you have doubt and being able to commit to the process to make it work. And so I'm nodding my head going, okay, you've got the right to say that. And then at the same time, I have this other thought, which is, you know, I don't know if I could set out to be world's best sumo wrestler. I don't know if I could set out to be, you know, a concert pianist. I'm now, you know, so many years past the learning phase of the mechanics where most people learn. So when I hear anything's possible, it's like, I don't want to wrestle with it, but I do. I don't want to send like a message to myself or others that sets them up for failure. But I also want to send this really clear message to think big and to really, yeah. So can you help me with that?
I think, you know, again, you said being a concert pianist. See, I thought if you came to me and said, Nicholas, you know what, I think that I can be a concert pianist, and I'm 100% focused, I'd be absolutely like, yeah, I think you can as well. Anything's possible. Because I think you said, you know, you're beyond the age of development regarding, you know, developing technique to be a pianist. But so was I. 14 is, I mean, the amount of teachers and people like, well, you've started too late, you'll never be, you know, you'll never be on the international circuit and things, you know. So in that sense, I still think but it has to come. You have to have that absolute diehard passion to be, you know, you have to. So, you know, being a concert pianist might not be, but I think if someone did think that, and that was absolutely, they had that image in their head and they were completely, like I was when I was 14, and that was my decision. It was a conscious decision. I was going to be, not just to play the piano, I was going to be a concert pianist. As in, my job was to play the piano around the world. Then I definitely do still stand by my little motto.
I love it, because, you know, You know, when you reach a certain age, I hear more people now my age, which I'm 40, what am I, 44. I hear people now my age saying, well, it's kind of too late to shift gears. And I find myself going, hold on, you could set out to do something. And then I hear myself playing back, well, I couldn't be a pianist. I couldn't be this. I couldn't be that. I don't have that drive to want to do any of those, really. And so it's
Yeah,
like
of course,
theoretically,
and
yeah.
I wouldn't, I couldn't have the same, and I wouldn't apply that motto, anything is possible, for me to be an Olympic diver, because I have no interest in that. I don't want to be to do that, so
Yeah.
I wouldn't, I don't feel I would succeed in that. But if there was something else, if I had something in my head where it's like I really, really want to do that, then I 100% still I still believe that and things like that.
And then so that same, your parents installed that idea, is that right? They
They
helped.
did, yeah, they did. They were great, my parents. Especially, I kind of, and I always give them credit. And when I'm doing interviews and things, I always like to mention them because I think it must have been so difficult for them. I was their first and only child. And what's the there's always that saying, which always makes me feel kind of a little bit sad but happy at the same time, that I've got the parents that I have. Where, when a baby's first born. And they're like, yeah, a healthy baby, 10 fingers and 10 toes. And with my mum and dad, it was like, healthy baby, but not quite the full set of 10 fingers and 10 toes. So I always feel quite kind of sad for them as kind of young pair, they're a young newly wed couple, and they were so excited for their firstborn. And with me, my arm didn't show up until I was born. So in the scans that my mum had throughout her pregnancy, and I always joke with them now and say I was hiding my arm. So it was a massive, massive shock for them. It was a huge shock. And I don't know how I would deal with that.
How did they? Have you ever asked them how they would
Yeah, I have.
intro?
My mum was upset. Oh, of course, she was upset. I would be as well. Well, I think they both were. And then I think my granddad had said to them, I think it was here, he said, look, he's no different, he's got one hand, it's fine, it's not going to be an issue, it's not the end of the world, he's a healthy baby. And so, and I think he just put it in, it helped wear away that shock, that initial shock is something which you can't get over, I think. And very quickly, I think they just accepted it. It is what it is. There's nothing they can do, nothing they can change.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's cool in the sense that they were honest with you of how they struggled with it, and then they
Yeah.
figured out an incredible thought to pass on to you, which is that anything is possible. And then I would imagine that carried through for you when you were applying to the Royal College of Music. And I don't know if they've accepted or they have a history of people that played left-handed music, but
I'm the only one.
you're the first and only.
Well, I didn't know that until I graduated. So I graduated in 2012, and after 4 years of study there. And on my graduation day, so I was in the robes, in my hat, whatever you call it, and my professor rang me up, and I was just about to walk on, to go on stage, rang me up and said, Nick, now you've actually, you're about to graduate. Now you've made history in becoming the first ever one-handed or left-handed pianist to graduate in 135 years, which of course I didn't. No, the college is only 100, well, 134 years old. So yeah, in that whole time, I was the only one, and I didn't realize that. And then the next day, all of the national news had picked up on it. So my graduation was in all the papers here, which was again something which I wouldn't have never ever have dreamt of or thought of would be something which I could say. So it was an amazing time. It was an amazing time. 2012 was when things really changed for me. A couple of weeks later, I played at the Paralympic closing ceremony with Coldplay. Like, who plays with Coldplay after graduating for 2 years? I mean, that summer was just mad, mad.
That's awesome. Yeah, very cool. What a great little boost coming right out of your college
Yeah,
experience.
I couldn't. I kept pinching myself the whole time, thinking like, is this happening now?
So is there a word or a phrase that cuts to the center of what you understand most?
what I understand most about
life, music, you, others.
You're asking a very good question.
Are you saying that because you don't know what to say, or is it like forcing you to think a certain way?
No, very good question, because you're really making me think of the things that I wouldn't think about ordinarily.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, okay, hold on, as you're getting your thoughts there, are you exceptional at what you do?
Without sounding full of myself, because there's always that, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But I would say, yes, I would say I'm very proud of what I can do at the piano. I'm very proud of my history and the fact I didn't start at the age of two. Mm-hmm. The fact, you know, there's all these things which I'm very proud of. So I would say yes, in as modest way as possible.
Yeah, no, right. And I just wanted to level set that because I don't know music like you know music. But when I listen to you play, I feel something. And it's not because you have one hand, it's because of the way that you've strung notes together. And you're playing pieces that are written for left-handed only, as I've come to understand. And it's not clunky, it's not, there's no distractions in it. It's that your craft is translating to convey some sort of internal experience for the listener. And so that feels like artistry. Now, I don't know, maybe I'm just making that up, but it feels like you've developed a command over left-handed pieces and music maybe in general, I don't know. But that being said, if you and I are going to nod our heads in the most humble of ways to say that, yes, you've got a command, there's always room to grow, but what is it that you understand most?
I mean, if I can just answer you, with regards to, you know, when you said, are you exceptional? There's faster. And I say this to people all the time. There's always somebody who can play things better, faster, cleaner than you. That is where, for me, it's about communicating something. So I'm so pleased that you've just mentioned the artistry and that's what you felt from my performances, because that is what I aim to do. And that is what I want to do. You know, I'm quite happy to say and have, you know, that, like I said, I'm not the best pianist in the entire planet. I don't think anybody is. I think that's impossible to be that. And if you are, if you feel you are that, then believe me, someone can play it better than you. But I think you can communicate through your craft, whatever that is. And I think that is the thing which makes you exceptional, if you can communicate through that medium. And that's what I hope I do. That's what I hope I do with my audiences. And from feedback from audiences, they tell me that I do, but I'm always constantly striving to do that more, to do that clearer, to do that, to communicate in a stronger way. So then getting back to, if I could think of a word, to cut through everything to do with, I suppose, me, my music, everything, I would say belief. That's what I would say, just one word, just belief. Because a lot of the time, and that applies to other people, you know, a lot of my audiences, they have come to see me because they've seen me on television, for instance. And they've only come to see me because they're curious. And I know that. I'm a curious person. We're human beings. But they've believed in me and they've had that belief in me that I am worth spending X amount of money on a ticket to go and see. Even if they're not interested in classical music, and believe me, a lot of people who come to my concerts aren't interested in classical music. But what I love is the fact that they come back time and time again and they bring more people and they bring more friends and they bring their family and they bring their mum. And those people are the ones that I hope that I have communicated through and touched in some way, you know, in some way. So I would say belief for me, belief in self, belief and all that, but also belief from other people, belief having them believe in me as an artist.
So what have you set, what are you setting out to do? Are you setting out to get approval from others because of all of the naysayers you had early? Or are you setting out to get to be a communicator? Or are you setting out to be famous? Or are you, what are you setting out to do?
I would say when I was younger, it used to just be getting approval from others. Mm-hmm. Then very quickly, it became not about that. It didn't bother me. It's that I don't care about that. And now I don't care about that. For me, it's about communicating and you know, the amount of times I see people and they come backstage after a concert and they're in tears about a piece that I've played which has touched them because it was their mum's favourite piece, or it, they're so happy because they've heard this piece and they didn't think it was possible to play with one hand. That is what I want to continue to do, and that is what makes my job so worthwhile, is me being able to create that emotion through that instrument.
And then if there was a belief,
somebody laugh, or make somebody happy, or make somebody sad, or whatever, me being able to create that through my music, which I love so much, that is what it's about for me.
So it really is a relationship with other people that you're doing. Yeah, okay.
The fame thing, and you know, I'm in the classical music industry, so there's only so far fame you can go. So that certainly isn't the case, otherwise I would have been a pop singer.
Got it, okay.
So yeah, the fame thing, that certainly isn't me. Obviously, that it's nice that I get to do some nice things now, which I wouldn't have been able to do before if I wasn't doing the job that I'm doing. But I would have picked certainly something more popular than classical music if I wanted to become famous. I would have been a reality star. That seems to get them everywhere at the moment. So.
It's probably a lot easier. Yeah. Is there a relationship with your inner critic that you can talk about? And the inner critic meaning that voice that would challenge your idea that anything is possible.
Now, my inner critic, you see, has got a bit of a full-time job with criticizing my playing. So, regarding criticizing my kind of, you know, myself, criticizing my motto, my belief that anything is possible, I don't think it does. I don't think I do self-critique that, because I believe it through and through.
When you are critical, what is that about?
When I'm critical, I think, you know, you're your worst critic. That's the saying, isn't it? And it's so true. And I think that is just about improvement. You know, it's constantly learning, constantly improving. You know, the day I come off stage and say, that was a fantastic performance and I was brilliant, well, that is the day that I will get quite worried. Because then I think I've become complacent, and I think that I've become too complacent with my playing. Whereas at the moment, which I think is good, is you know, I come off stage, and of course, you know, I'm a concert pianist, and my standard has to be a certain standard, and there's not going to be, you know, littered with wrong notes and I cut, you know, playing horrible things. It's not going to be like that. But I'm saying, critiquing about, you know, that G sharp wasn't great in that third movement, and that was a bit loud in the fourth movement there, and that, you know, it was just kind of self-critiquing in a way of improvement. So next time when I go to play that piece publicly, I can think, last time I did it, let's do something differently here, let's do that there. And I think that is so important, because it's, you know, yes, as a performer you're always striving for perfection, but perfection doesn't exist. And I think that is why it's always that self-critique, that self-criticism, which I value a lot. It's very important.
Okay. Do you have a particular story that comes to mind with your relationship with risk-taking, especially when you've got a critic, inner critic, that's, you know, telling you that it's not good enough, basically? And do you have a story that comes to mind about risk-taking?
Yeah, I do, but I can't think off the top of my head. But I think with me, with risk, I've always been a risk taker regarding my choices of repertoire. You know, you see some pianists or some performers or whatever, they always, you know, play it quite safe with programming a program of music together or whatever they're doing. With me, I've always been wanting to push myself. You know, I'm not just going to be programming pieces which I find simple, which I find easy. I'm going to be programming pieces which I find extremely difficult, extremely challenging, pieces which don't necessarily agree with my technique, because as a pianist, we always have strengths and weaknesses. So I do enjoy, I enjoy doing that. I enjoy getting my teeth into that. So I would say in that respect, I'm a risk taker. And again, with recording, like with when I recorded the album, there was things which I put on the album which people would, which I know people say are notoriously difficult pieces to play. Yet I wanted to program them for me, really, for me to so I can say, right, well, that is such a big challenge. It's so difficult, but I've recorded them. And they're on the album. You know, I like to do that. I like to take risks.
Okay, so on that note, and then threading back a couple other concepts here, is that you've got, we opened up with this decoding the process that goes, that you've become masterful at when the world says you can't or somebody says you can't, and you sort out how you can, and then you commit to it. And also that anything is impossible, and that you, what the thing you understand most is belief. And that you structurally embrace risk-taking, probably to put you on point so that you get that just the right amount of energy when you go on stage. And you've got a relationship with the inner critic that helps keep you sharp. I don't know if it slows you down or accelerates your performance. I'm not sure yet. I think you like it. And then, so now that gets me to this one question, that is, if with all of that being understood about you, if you could help install a belief to the listeners, what belief would you want to install or help them understand most?
Believe. I would say to listen to yourself, to listen to, you know, we all have those voices inside, you know, we all have our inner self telling us things. And a lot of people ignore that. A lot of people try and ignore it. So I would try and get the listeners just to believe in that inner self, because that belief in your inner self really can help you achieve amazing things.
And then on, do you have a framework that supports that relationship with your inner self? Like, is there a spiritual framework or a philosophical framework that either that you've grown up with that helps to keep that relationship with you and the world intact in some kind of way?
I don't think so. I think I'm just very, I think I do, I'm just quite in tune with listening to what my body is telling me, to listen to what my inner self is telling me, or not telling me at the same time. I just think that is a relationship I have. I'm not sure I do have, you know, a framework which kind of enables that to be stronger, or, you know, whatever.
And then how do, okay, so how do you keep yourself mentally strong? Like, what is the process for you to do that?
I think the thing, like I mentioned earlier in when we were chatting, you know, my little routine that I have, you know, going to the gym, going for a run, having that clear headspace where my thoughts can just wander, or can be frenetic if they need to be, or can be thinking about grocery shopping if they need to be. You know, do that space. I think in our society now, there isn't really any time. People don't take time to be silent. We're surrounded by music. People have got earphones in 24 hours a day. So there's never any time just to be with your thoughts. And I think for me that is so important. That and that's why I one of the reasons I do go running is because of that. So I would say, yeah, that's very important, that routine, that silence that I have daily. I love that a lot.
I concur 1,000%. The value, like at some point in time, machines are going to take over menial tasks or jobs that do not require thinking, deep thinking. And what's going to be left is artistry and creative, deep problem solving and thinking. And if those of us that fall behind on being aware of thoughts, because that's what thinking is, right? Stringing thoughts together. Those of us that become unaware of our thoughts are going to have a disadvantage. All that, maybe that's just, you know, the futurizing of the apocalypse. But, you know, I don't want it to be doom and gloom as I'm sharing it. But maybe another more eloquent way of saying is one of the greatest assets we have as human beings is to be able to think and to think deeply. And if we're not careful based on the surface level of media that we're bombarded with, that our ability to think deeply is compromised. And part of thinking deeply requires the ability to focus deeply. And with all of the noise as a counterbalance that's coming in from all different parts of life, whether that be social media or regular media or just even the gray noise in the background from traffic and pollution and chit-chat from other people across whatever modes of transportation there are in the background, that all of that noise can become a saturation for the ability to focus deeply. And so, the long-winded way of me saying focusing deeply to think deeply is one of the hallmarks of being human. And I get concerned with what I witness and what I feel within myself when I don't do it myself and what I observe in other people. And one of the threads that's come through on these conversations on this podcast is that people really do value creating space to feel and to think. And it sounds like, you're right on that same path.
Yeah, I don't think I could create what I do create with music without that space, without that time to think, without that, and like I say to you, it's not about me thinking very deeply about, sometimes it is, but sometimes it is just very superficial things which are going through my head, but it is just allowing my head to have that.
Brilliant.
That is so important, I think.
Brilliant. Okay. So let's see if we can kind of round the corner here. I'd love for you to just bang off some like, numbers from 1 to 10, and any commentary obviously is welcome, but on 1 to 10, with 10 being high and then 1 being low on a scale, if you would, how important is the mental aspect of the game for you?
9.
And then your ability to switch on and to be on point?
10.
Your ability to switch off and to de-escalate intensity?
10.
And your ability to manage internal distractions?
I think for me, maybe 5.
Mm-hmm. And your ability to manage external distractions?
10.
Your ability to lock in and focus when it's dangerous?
8.
When it's boring?
10.
10? Really? Okay. Why do you laugh when you answer that one?
Because sometimes you have to, when you're, and I'm talking in my head when I'm answering these, I'm talking about performing. I'm mm-hmm. talking about my performances and things.
Okay.
And sometimes you can go, it's like with comedians when they say you're playing to a dry house.
Mm.
That happens in classical music as well. Sometimes you can walk out on stage and you could be giving the most electrifying performance, but you're not getting that energy and that excitement back from the crowd sometimes. And it's not because they don't like you. It just happens like that. So that is, and you sense it as an artist. So it's very important for me to be able, and that's when I call, with boredom, it's very important for me to kind of switch off from that.
Yeah. You know what I've noticed, and I'd love to hear your take on this, is that oftentimes public speaking is very hostile for people. And one of the reasons I think it's hostile is because their ego and or their identity is fused with their thinking, their ability to think clearly, and their reputation that others are ascribing to them. And so it becomes this internally very hostile experience for so many people. And one of the triggers, I think, is that if you are looking out into the world and we're trying to read other people's microfacial expressions and body language to see if we're okay, that when we go on stage, there's a blank look. There's a completely blank look. And if our model is to look to others to see if we're okay, and then when we're on stage and we're using that, applying that same model, which is to look to the audience to see we're okay, people are going to get screwed up on stage, because oftentimes audiences aren't giving anything, especially if there's bright lights, you know, on who's ever on stage.
And so, that's the thing, you're completely right, because I think, you know, if you were a comedian, for instance, you know if they like you, because they're laughing out loud, or if they don't like you, you're being heckled. And like when a sports person, you know, if you're like, you get huge cheers, and it's that electricity and that buzz. Whereas with classical, obviously we rely on silence in the concert hall and when you're performing on stage. So you don't often know until after. And bear in mind, you know, you can be playing and work for 45 minutes sometimes without stopping. If you're playing a, you know, piano concerto, for instance, and you've got that 45 minutes, the applause doesn't come until the end. So that whole 45 minutes of doing something, really, you don't know if you've done a good job, or if the audience feels you've done a good job and if they like what you've done, right until the end. And even then, I mean, I've played concerts, and especially when I was at the beginning of my career, when, you know, I was playing smaller concerts than I do now. And, you know, I'd be playing a small concert to, say, 50 people or something. And you would play this concert, and the applause afterwards that you'd get, it would be as if they weren't enjoying it. It would be as if they didn't like you. And that used to be really hard for me, because I would convince myself that they didn't like me at all. Until afterwards, I'd sign CDs, and out of, you know, 50 people, kind of, you know, 39 would buy CDs and tell me how wonderful the recital was and how much they loved it. Yet they weren't showing it. They weren't showing it in their applause. It was the flattest applause ever. You know, their facial expressions were very flat. Yet actually, sometimes people just don't know how to express that.
And so, who determines if a piece is successful? Do you determine it, or does the vibrance of the applause determine it?
I think it's a combination of both. Mm. I think, you know, obviously I know if something's not quite gone as I'd wanted it to go, or if it's gone absolutely amazingly. And I think, you know, if it has gone absolutely amazingly, yet the applause is very flat, then that would worry me. You know, it happens very rarely, luckily. But yeah, I think also sometimes the smaller the audience, the audience members get a bit scared, as in etiquette-wise, especially in classical, as in they don't know what to do, they don't feel hugely comfortable. So often, you know, the applause won't be that full if it was a small audience. And hence why it's difficult for people at the beginning of their careers, because you are playing to small audiences. Now, when, you know, we're playing to much larger audiences, there's almost like strength in numbers, you know. So people are more free to applaud for a longer amount of time and to make you feel appreciated as an artist, because, that, like I say, strength in numbers, it does kind of give them that ability.
Mm, okay, cool. Go back to 1 to 10. Are you motivated by external rewards, or your motivation of external rewards? You know, money, fame, attention, applause, all that stuff. 1 to 10.
8.
Motivated by internal rewards, the sense and the feeling that comes with mastery.
10.
Your fear of failure.
Used to be, and is in 10 the most. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it used to be 10 when I was first starting out, and kind of, you know, up to about maybe 20, 21. Now it's about 5.
Okay. And then is it 1 to 10 looking bad as compared to, I'll ask you another one, consequences of loss. So 1 to 10 looking bad.
As in, oh, so me looking bad.
Mm-hmm.
5.
And then the consequence of, like, blowing it on stage, coming up short, if you will.
The consequence of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe 6.
6, yeah. Your fear of success, 1 to 10?
one.
I love that. How important is music in your life outside of work?
10.
Spirituality?
6.
Science?
8.
Breaking rules?
10.
Taking risk?
10.
Being self-critical?
9.
Relationships with intimate others?
10.
Having great habits?
5.
Sleep?
10. Very important to me.
Caffeine?
1. I don't drink coffee.
You don't drink coffee. Okay. And then of all the mental skills, which is the one that you think is most important? Is it generating that calm intensity? Is it confidence? Is it the ability to focus deeply? Is it using your imagination to create images of success? Or is it maybe like a pre-performance routine or something to put you on point?
I would say confidence. I think that can be used in so many things. You know, you can draw that confidence on stage or public speaking or just meeting up with somebody for an interview, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think confidence, I would say that's the one for me.
Beautiful. Okay. So lastly, like, how do you define or articulate mastery? What is the ways that you talk about this?
For being a pianist, of course, it's a given that high technical ability is a must. But the communication aspect for me, and that applies to not just myself, when I go and see other musicians perform, that's what I want to see, is the communication. I want them to speak to me. I want me to feel something. The amount of times I've been to concerts and I've seen amazing technical firework displays at the piano or on the violin or whatever, yet I've left that console feeling completely cold and untouched. And that, I think, is a shame. So being a master and, you know, mastering your craft is, for me, about absolutely being able to communicate to your audience, including audiences who aren't usually audiences of your genre, if you like. Mm. So that applies to pop, you know.
Mm, beautiful. Okay. And then, Nicholas, where can we learn more about what you're up to and what you're doing? And, you know, give us all the links where we can go get your music and figure out, you know, how we can observe you doing your thing. And I don't know if you have plans coming to the States anytime soon, or for the European listeners, if you're on tour now, but, you know, give me everything, you know, social, yeah. Give me everything.
So I think the best place for your listeners to kind of see me in action, because that's, you know, essentially, yes, it's about listening as well, but I think, because a lot of your listeners won't have heard of me before, won't have seen me play, I think go on YouTube, go onto my YouTube channel, Nicholas McCarthy Pianist, and just see what I do and make your decision. See if you like it, see if you like the music. You know, there's so many videos on there. So yeah, at the moment I'm just about to go on my UK tour over here, my UK album tour, my album, which I called Solo. For two reasons it's called Solo. One, it's my debut album and it's solo piano, so that's an obvious one. But two, it's solo hand, single hand. So I wanted to almost to remind people of that in the title, because often when you're listening to an audio CD, people forget that it's only one hand playing, because it does sound like two hands, if you like. So I actually recorded my album over in Boston, over in the States. So of course, I'd love your listeners to go and have a listen to the album, see what they think, and let me know what they think. Come and say hi on Twitter. I'm always on Twitter, N McCarthy Piano, and also on my Facebook page, Nicholas McCarthy Pianist. And yeah, I'd love to see what your listeners' thoughts are on my playing and on my performances.
I have no doubt there's going to be loads of questions. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation that will extend this conversation. And so it's N as in Nancy, or N as in Nicholas McCarthy, MCCARTHY. And that's your Twitter handle, right? N McCarthy.
Piano, yeah, N. McCarthy Piano.
Oh, that's Twitter. Perfect. Okay. So, Nicholas, thank you so much. I was excited and fired up to meet you, and I really appreciate you helping me understand the process that you go through to be able to tackle and to be able to go for it. And so, thank you so much. And for the rest of folks that are listening, thank you for being part of this journey and this conversation. And you can go to iTunes and look for Finding Mastery if you're brand new to this conversation. And then you can also find out more information about Nicholas on findingmastery.net. Please hit us both up on social. My Twitter handle is at Michael Gervais, and you can also go to facebook.com/findingmastery. Okay, Nicholas, great to meet you. Loved how you've articulated, and you are excellent at communicating. So I want to thank you so much for your time and wish you all the best success. And I'm looking forward to catching up in the future and just to learn how your tour is going. So let's make sure we find some time to do that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Okay, all the best. Have a great afternoon.
Take care. Bye,
Okay,
Michael.
bye.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.